I'm really grateful to Curtis for setting up this chance to come and speak on these topics. I'm grateful to a lot of you were asking really good questions yesterday morning and last night, and I appreciate that as well. And I have to thank Lisa, and I don't know if Lisa's in here, but she, bless her heart, opened her home to me, and they have entertained me very well, so I'm grateful for that too. I got to tell you, though, that this topic, how do I trust God when suffering, this is my least favorite of all the topics I do when I give one of these seminars on Christian evidences. I don't like talking about this one, and there's a couple of reasons. The biggest one, though, is that I'm gonna give reasons for trusting God in spite of suffering, and I always feel like a jerk when I do that because I know that in every audience I'm addressing, there are people who are suffering and have suffered far more severely than I have experienced in my life. I've had, you know, my share, I guess, of grief and suffering, but I know there are people who are really in the middle of that battle. And it's easy when you're talking about this to come off as a insensitive jerk. So I always approach this one with some trepidation, to be honest. I think it's important for us to talk about because a lot of people really view, let's see if I can, does this thing work? Do I have to, okay, yeah, there it is. It just, yeah, all right. Technology. And I used this all day yesterday, too. That's kind of sad. Many atheists consider the question of this claim, God, if there really were a God, wouldn't allow so much suffering, as kind of the only real argument they need to mount. Most of the time, atheists are content to sit back and just poke holes in whatever evidence we present for God and say, didn't convince me yet, didn't convince me yet, didn't convince me yet. This is the one time typically where atheists kind of go on the attack and say, no, you can't believe in God. God is actually logically ruled out because if God is really loving, what we know about loving people is that they prevent suffering. If they have the power to do it, they prevent suffering. If your child is sick, you do anything you can to try and help them get over their illness. And if you had the power, you would cure them instantly. Well, God has that power. And so you're telling me that he's loving, and yet he lets my child linger in illness. He lets my wife be very sick. He lets my father or my mother suffer and waste away and die from cancer. If God were really who you Christians say he is, then the world would be a far different place. And the fact that the world is full of so much evil, so much suffering, is all the proof we need to say that God does not exist. That's the form of the argument. And I think we need to be able to talk to people in a rational way about that question and say some things about it. The first thing I think we need to do as Christians is to make sure we ourselves are aware of, and we ourselves are communicating the whole truth about God. And what I mean is, if you only sing the praise songs, and if you form your theology and your picture of God from the songs of praise, I don't care if it's the old songs or the new songs, but if that's the only part of the liturgy that you pay attention to, then Jesus is your friend. God is your loving Father. You're going to get a particular vision of God that makes this problem of why does God allow suffering then much, much worse. And that may be okay for mature Christians, but if we're bringing people in and trying to enculturate them and teach them about the gospel, we need to do more to help them get a full picture of God, what God is really like, than just God is my loving Father. He is all those things. But there's more going on. And so we need to remind ourselves of our fundamental stories. God loved Abraham. Did he not? God loved Isaac. Did he not? And yet we have this truly horrifying story if you actually try to put yourself in it and imagine it, where God says, yeah, I know I made you wait for 30 years to have this son, and I know that you've been able to watch him grow up for the last 14 years, and there's horrible infant mortality in your culture, and yet he made it through all those childhood diseases, and here he is as a fine, you know, young, budding adolescent, and so you take him and you go kill him. Now, we know the rest of the story, those of us who have read the Bible. We know that it ended up being one of the great blessing passages in the story that Abraham has. Another announcement of the land promise and various other things that come out of that. It was a deep testing personally for Abraham, and God blesses him and, of course, prevents the sacrifice. We know all that. Abraham didn't know that. Does God love Abraham or not? He loves him. He was totally willing to put Abraham through that. We need to make sure that we're telling people the full story about God. The story of Joseph is the same way. It ends really well. Joseph says, I see that you intended it to harm me. God intended it for good. This great good of the saving of all of these people. That's the way Joseph sums it up. And I'm glad Joseph eventually comes to that conclusion. But what would it have been like to actually live through Joseph's life? Your own brothers grab you, throw you into a pit, and stand around the top of the pit saying, now how would we like to kill him? We could just drop rocks on him, we could stab him to death. I mean, what would be the best way to do that? Can you imagine listening to people discussing the appropriate way to murder you? And, you know, as an act of mercy, they sell him into slavery to a land he doesn't know people there. He doesn't have any resources there. And things just get bad, 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 bad. We know it ends up with an incredible blessing. He becomes second in command in Egypt because we've read the rest of the book. He didn't have the rest of the book. Does God love Joseph or not? God loves Joseph, totally willing for his greater purposes to put Joseph through that kind of suffering. We need to make sure we tell people the whole truth about God. Story of Job is the same way. All of these things take place in the life of Job. Does God love Job or not? He does love Job, and he's willing to let Satan put him to incredible tests, breaking point tests. And so I think we need to make sure we are aware of that. Even, you know, the worst story is Jesus, who truly never ate the forbidden fruit. Never committed a sin in his life. I understand why God tells me no, because I'm a pretty rotten person anyway. But Jesus never did anything to disappoint his father. He asks for this. He says, let this cup pass from me. And his father says, no. Does God love the son? Does the father love the son? Yes. He's willing to let him go through this. I'm going to say something. I know this is being recorded. This may be heresy. I don't know. You evaluate it as you want. I will say God is incredibly good, better than we can imagine him to be. God is not nice. I don't think you can call God nice. He's good, incredibly good, loving, incredibly loving. I don't think he's nice. What makes a nice neighbor? You can talk. Go ahead. Yeah. What makes a nice neighbor? Okay, yeah. Give me an example of a nice neighbor. He'll help you with your Christmas decorations. Yeah, what else? He'll help you mow your yard if you need him to. And he doesn't let his dog come over and dig up your flowers or his kids play in a rock band next to your wall or any of that. That's right. Just doesn't bug you, doesn't cause distress to you. That's not God. You know, when we have trouble, it's not because God doesn't love us. But what we know about God is he has a plan. He is taking the world somewhere. The world has fallen. He is fixing that. He is bringing us back to where everyone can be blessed. And he is willing to put his people through all kinds of suffering for the pursuit of that path of his. And that's the real God. We need to make sure that we read all the Bible. About a third of the Psalms are complaint Psalms. This is not a new problem. About a third of them are saying, God, you used to do really great stuff. We've been raised hearing the stories of what you did and to the Egyptians to bring us out of captivity. Where are you now? Why don't you do something today? I mean, have you ever actually read those Psalms? It's like, I'd be scared to pray that. There were people who were singing that to God. That's because that's the real God. We are constantly, frequently puzzled by why God is asking of us the things that he's asking of us and why he doesn't take more steps. And I think that's just part of the condition of faith. I want to divide this problem into two sections. And it really is two different problems. One is the logical problem, which if you're dealing with an atheist who's really trying to present a logical argument to you, you're dealing with the logical problem. There is the claim made by many atheists that we have a piece of data that we can look at in our world. There is lots of suffering. And from that data, with some logical steps, we can reach a factual conclusion, God does not exist. That's the logical problem. Is that true? Can you construct a sound argument from the data of suffering exists in the world, step by step, by reliable steps, to the conclusion God does not exist? That's the logical problem. I'll just tell you right now, nobody has ever made that work. I mean, this argument has been around for a long, long time. Nobody's actually ever given us a totally sound argument to get from the fact of suffering to the non-existence of God. And there's some real reasons why that is, which we'll talk about in a minute. Logically, this argument is a failure. And in one sense, it doesn't matter at all, because the real guts of this argument is not logic. The real guts of this argument is the emotions of it. I can be a Christian for 40 years, and when I'm called on to suffer, or worse, when my loved ones are called on to suffer, and I can do nothing except pray, and I don't feel like God is even answering my prayers when I pray, that's when this becomes an incredibly difficult problem for my faith. It doesn't mean I disbelieve in God, it's just that I kind of hate God. I'm really mad at him. And again, read the Psalms. Read what Job says. I mean, we talk about the patience of Job. He's pretty fierce with what he says to God. And we kind of need to be aware of that truth. It's the emotional problem that keeps people coming back and thinking that there's a logical argument here. I don't think there is one. And I'll give you some reasons. And what I would say is, don't mix these two up. If you don't hear anything else I say in this class, hear that. Don't mix these two up. And what I mean by that is, you can have an elder in the church, a preacher in the church, an elder's wife who's been faithful for years and years and years, and when grief is upon that person, you may hear words as fierce as Job's coming out of that person's mouth. I hate God. God is my enemy. I will never pray again. And that's grief. Grief will do that. Those emotions are strong. They're raw. And it's just like the only bit of relief I get is by pushing them out of my mouth. If you stand there and sort of, let's talk about C.S. Lewis's problem of pain. Here are the arguments that he got. Do you realize how worthless that kind of thing would be? Attempting to give an answer to the logical argument when someone is in the midst of the emotional struggle is going to be worse than worthless. I think you can actually push somebody over into atheism by trivializing, in a sense, what's actually going on with them, reducing it to a matter of logic when it's really a struggle of the heart. And so I think we need to make sure we keep those two things separate. Let's talk about the logical problem just a little bit. I said I don't think it works at all, because nobody's ever been able to construct an argument that really does work. The claim is God's all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving, and a God like that just wouldn't allow any suffering. We see suffering, therefore, there is no God. And there's 100 variations on that kind of argument, but that's essentially how it works. And the problem is it doesn't follow logically because of that second premise. God would not allow any suffering. How are you going to know something like that? What God would or wouldn't allow? How good are you, a human being, going to be at a psychoanalysis of the supreme being? That's actually the Achilles heel of every form of the problem from suffering. Think about it. How smart is God? Pardon? All the smarts. That's right. It's all the smarts. When we say omniscient, that's all we're saying is all the smarts there are. God has them. How smart are you? We're kind of smart, but how far short of understanding and comprehending God are we always going to fall, no matter how smart we make ourselves? We are always going to be infinitely away from truly comprehending God. Every form of the logical argument of suffering, at some point, you just have to look for it, at some point it's going to have a premise which involves us being able to psychoanalyze God and say, well, I'm sure that God would never allow the Holocaust. I know for a fact God would never allow, you know, this disease, or he would never have allowed this tsunami. You don't know that. You can say you know it, but there's no way in which you actually know what would or wouldn't be within God's plans. You just don't know that. And so logically, this never does work. In addition, we actually know that good beings who love us that aren't God, like our parents and our teachers and so forth, frequently allow suffering or even inflict some suffering out of love for a greater purpose. And we all have experiences like that. I remember very well. This is how old I am. This will date me. I actually lived through both types of polio vaccines. So unfair. My little sister, she just got a nice little sugar cube. It was awesome. But I went through the 3 injections. You guys know that? I was 4 years old when the first one came. I trusted my mother. Walked with her like a lamb to the slaughter to the doctor's office. And this nurse came along and just jammed this giant needle. When you're 4, needles just look so much bigger. Jammed it into my arm. I can't believe I'm betrayed like that. That's not the worst part. 6 months later, you got to go back and have dose number 2. And 6 months after that, you got to go back and have dose number 3. And it was that second one that was the horror. Because I knew it when she put me in the car. I was crying just driving to the doctor's office. I was bawling when she walked me up the sidewalk. I was making a scene in the whole neighborhood in the waiting room. Please, Mom, please don't let them stick me. Please don't let them give me a shot. Please, please, please. She just totally held me down and let them give me a shot. Now, she's a good woman. She loves me. Why did she do that? Because my granddad had polio when he was 12. He was crippled the rest of his life. And he died early because of that. She would have let me have 100 shots to keep me safe from that disease. I mean, that's just the way it is. Good people do often allow some suffering for the sake of a greater good. And so we know that that rule doesn't work anyway, even if we didn't have the logical problem I pointed out earlier. There's another thing I think we can say. When we try to analyze the kind of world we live in, what has God revealed about himself to us? If you ask Christians, God is fill in the blank, what's the usual answer they give? God is love is usually in the top 3. God is love. Now, that's Christians specifically. We have a different take on that than other theistic groups like Muslims or Jewish people or theistic Hindus or so forth. There are other monotheisms in the world. But ours is the one that is uniquely focused around love because we believe Jesus Christ is God in the flesh, and we believe he demonstrated the nature of God by offering himself in sacrifice. So we believe God, love is key to who God is. What's God accomplishing with us on the earth? What does he want? His will. And specifically, when somebody asked Jesus, okay, could you sum it up for me? Well, like, what's the most important thing for human beings to do? What does Jesus say? Love God. God is love. So part of how we become what God wants us to be is to learn to love God back. And the second one is like it. What? Love your neighbor as yourself. If you want to understand what your mission is on earth, it's that. It just varies by what situation you're in and what people God has put into your life. But it's always that. Love God with all you've got. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Learning to do that is what has been wrong with the world and what will set the world right. And it's by the example of Jesus Christ, by the power of the Holy Spirit, that we begin to make progress towards loving one another. That's really, I think, what God wants from us. And if you think about that, you realize there are a number of features of the world that sort of fit that purpose of God, to teach us to love God and to teach us to love each other as we love ourselves. There are a number of features that I think do that. That God has made a world in which we learn the virtue of self-sacrificing love. What are some of the things that we would need in a world that was designed to help us, to train us to be loving? What would that take? Well, I think the church does that. I think there are some other things as well. I think that's right. We're going to have the opportunity to sacrifice. I think we're going to have start with freedom. Let's just start with free will. If I had a potion that I could give to you and you would fall in love with me, at least you would say, "I love you, Jim." And you would bring me flowers and, chocolates, which is always a good thing. And you would say loving things and you would do loving. Is that love? Here's a poser. Can God force you to love him? He's all powerful. Can he force you to love him? I don't actually think he can. I think what is built into love, he can force us to do all the things that a loving person would do. I don't think that would be love, because I think love, by definition, is a choice. I offer that to you. If God chooses to make us loving, he's choosing to make us free. And unfortunately, what happens if God chooses to make us free? He chooses to make us free for something good, so that we can actually grow to love him, to love one another as we love ourselves. But what if I take the other choice? I start loving myself way more than I love God. I start loving myself way more than I love the people around me. I start injecting into the world all kinds of disorder and pain and sin. I mean, it's as simple as that. By making us so that we are capable of freely giving one another and giving God love, God makes it at least possible that some of us will abuse that freedom. In fact, all of us abuse that freedom and do other things. And that injects pain into the world. By itself, that injects pain into the world. Second, God needs to give us the opportunity to make not just any free choices, but choices to love that matter a lot. They need to matter to me, but they also need to matter to other people as well. If God made a world, this is the arguments of a philosopher named Richard Swinburne, if God made a world in which you had the opportunity to love one another by bringing each other a cupcake one time in your life, that would sort of be loving. Right? But it really wouldn't be as rich and deep as the way that God has actually set it up, where I have the ability to love the people around me in very deep and sometimes quite profound ways. And God has set it up so that I have opportunities that are repeated and frequent and sort of built into the fabric of human life to learn to love the people that are around me. But unfortunately, because he gives me decisions that matter a lot, are you going to take care of your family? Are you going to nourish your children? Are you going to treat them with respect and honor? those are things that I can do to love them. If I refuse to love, what's going to start happening? To totally innocent people. No, I'm not going to feed my children. No, I'm not going to treat them with respect. No, I'm going to abuse them when I'm angry or when they, well, I think they deserve it. And instead of a world where love predominates, I can choose to take the world several steps down from that. And again and again and again, human beings have done that. There's a lot of suffering in the world that's there just because God has given us the freedom to love in significant ways, and we have rejected frequently that freedom to love in significant ways. I mean, think about it like this. If you were God, this example just tickles me. If you were God and you could do anything you wanted to make the human race, would you have truly made men and women? No. That's the best plan you can come up with for reproduction is men and women? Isn't that a crazy idea? My wife says, it's like God thought, I will put two different species on the planet, and the only way that they can survive is if they manage to not kill each other long enough to reproduce. What a crazy idea that is. But from the aspect of teaching us to get outside of our own selfishness and to get outside of our own interest and care about somebody else, which is what agape love is all about, what does that force me to do? What does that force me to do? Yeah. I got married, and lo and behold, the next week I realized, man, I cannot be happy unless I figure out how to make her happy. I didn't realize I was signing up for that. This is crazy. I'm actually going to have to consider the feelings of somebody else, and I'm going to have to think about what she's thinking so I can work to... And she was trying to do the same thing with me. And you see what God's doing? He's built in all these ways to kind of pull us out of the little tight little circle of our own selfishness and self-concern, and to put us into a situation where we can actually give God love and give each other love. Again and again and again. And actually, there are several things built into the human system that are like that. We don't exist except in societies. We are barely human except when we are with other humans, right? I mean, how many of you, if you had to provide the resources that you've used just this morning, would starve to death? Your clothes, how many of you can make your own clothes? Your house, how many of you can make your own house? The food you ate, how many of you can also grow your own food? And we could just go on and on and on. Humans work better when we live in societies, but, and that's kind of the way we're structured, if we live in societies, what does that call out of us? How does that work against our own self-centeredness? Again and again and again, I've got to think, okay, well, I got to make a deal with so-and-so to get what I need, and I got to give him something he needs, so I got to figure out what he's thinking, you know, or she's thinking. And again and again and again, in a thousand different ways, God has set up the world so that we will learn to get out of our own circle of selfishness and give to others. I mean, think about babies. Human babies are the most helpless babies there are. And they're helpless for a lot longer. You know? Honestly, I mean, I know they're cute and all, especially when they're close to you, but if you just think about it rationally, what in the world does a baby give you? Just this incredible noise that has the ability to just kind of like hook into your nervous center and wake you up from a dead sleep and force you to pace the floor for hours at a time. They give you moisture from both ends and gross things, you know. And what are you getting out of this relationship? Maybe. That is like one of God's master classes in agape. I want to give you humans just a little taste of what I do for you. So I'm going to have you take care of these infants. And you'll get a little feeling of what it is to be your creator. and to care for you day after day, to give you the sun you need and to give you the rain you need and to give you the world that you need to keep you alive. So you'll know a little bit. And that pulls us out of our circle of selfishness. It pulls us into the circle of caring for other people the way that we care for ourselves. If we are going to survive long enough to learn to love, we're going to have a pain mechanism. It looks like pain is a blessing, not a curse. I know people don't like pain. I don't like pain. But it turns out pain is one of the things that keeps us living, keeps us alive. When I was a kid, I saw the movie Hawaii. Again, that dates me. That tells you how old I am. Some of you are old enough to remember the movie Hawaii. Others are way too young. And the scene that burned in my memory in that movie was the visit to the leper colony. Father Damien's leper colony on one of the small Hawaiian islands. And that just freaked me out. I was like 6 years old. I really didn't know how to process what I was seeing. Because there were people, because of leprosy, who were, you know, fingers, hands were maimed, faces were eaten away, you know, noses, ears gone, feet gone. You know, and I just thought leprosy is this horrible, you know, flesh-eating, you know, slowly consumes you from the outside in disease. What actually, what we're calling leprosy, Hansen's disease, what actually is the effect, the symptom of Hansen's disease, leprosy? Anybody know? The only real thing it does is it deadens your nerves. So you cannot feel your extremities at all. You can't feel pain, can't feel pleasure, can't feel anything in your extremities. All that stuff about fingers and feet and noses and stuff being gone, that's just the after effect of living without the ability to detect your what's going on with your body. Pain keeps us safe. If I step on a nail, I am going to deal with that problem very, very quickly. But if I can't feel anything, when am I even going to notice I've stepped on a nail? How long is it going to be? I don't ever look at the bottom of my feet if I can help it. When am I going to notice that I've got a nail driven up into my flesh? Creepily, no, I'm not going to feel the pain if I've got leprosy. And so creepily, it's probably when I start smelling something odd. You know? It's starting to rot. Well, by then, of course, the damage is 1,000 times worse than it would have been otherwise. Pain is what God gives to us and to animals to keep us safe. It's actually our initial pain response is the fastest nerve response we've got in our bodies. Special myelin sheaths that carry the signals very, very, very quickly so that I can respond very, very fast to get away from whatever it is that's damaging me. God gave us that. There was actually a philosopher, David Hume, who said, why can't God have just done it with with pleasure instead? So everybody's kind of at a level of pleasure, and if you are hurting yourself, you kind of just lose a few notches of pleasure. If God really loved us, he could have done it like that. You see any problems with David Hume's proposal? That's true. That's true. And also, what about this idea of being at a constant level of pleasure? Let's say I'm at 20. We need a nice word for units of pleasure. What would that be? Pardon? A 10? Yeah, but I need a name to call it. We got calories for heat. What would be a good name? A what? A degree? Yeah, I'm going to go with a Snickers. So you got 10 Snickers. You got 10 Snickers of pleasure all the time. And if you hurt yourself, you kind of drop down to 8 or 7, you know, and then you that motivates you to get back up to 10. Say it again. That's right. If you're subject to any constant stimulation, what eventually happens to that stimulation? You stop hearing it. Habituation. You stop hearing the noise. You stop smelling that smell. You stop, being aware of that thing until something changes. It's change that triggers our awareness. And so actually, if we were set at 100 Snickers or 20 Snickers or whatever, we would eventually, it wouldn't matter at all. And then a drop down to 17 Snickers from 20. We would be right back saying, why, God, why do you hate me? How can you let me drop to 17 Snickers? I can't believe that you're so cruel. A good God would never let anybody drop. And so I don't think there is a solution along those paths. God created something in pain that makes us quickly react. It teaches us lessons so that we learn, other people learn, even animals learn from the pain experiences and from other animals' pain experiences. He's given us a mechanism that with the minimum suffering creates the maximum benefit. And we can understand why he would do that if he's going to make us free in a world where we are trying to learn to love. We also need an orderly world, a world where I can actually make choices that matter. And that means I need a law-like world, a world with actual laws of nature where the same thing happens again and again and again and again. If I plant a seed, well, if I plant a lot of seeds, I have a really good chance that those kind of plants are going to grow up. If I live in a world that's chaotic, I plant a seed and the ground eats my finger. Or I plant a seed and I suddenly get Hondas. Or I plant a seed and nothing happens for two or three times. I mean, if anything can happen based on anything I do, I don't have any reason to do any one thing. Because the universe doesn't react. In order to have a world where I can act at all, I have to have a world with laws of nature, something, regularities and laws of nature. But here's the problem. If I've got laws of nature, I can have natural disasters. Correct? I can have small and large natural disasters. If the world is cruising along according to certain laws that I can understand and use, and if I get in the way of those laws, I can hurt myself. I really like the law of gravity, but if I'm using a hammer and I let it go above my toe, the law of gravity is going to create a small natural disaster for my toe, right? That's because I freely got in the way of the effects of one of the laws. And that's, you know, we think about tsunamis and all of those things, but those are just laws of nature that human beings and animals sometimes get in the way of. Yeah, that's right. An environment with natural laws is likely to produce big and little natural disasters. That's just part of how God does it. And I think to make a world where love is possible, God has to give us the opportunity to make great self-sacrifices, not just small self-sacrifices. If you listed the people that you admire most, there would be some variation in this group, but I know the kinds of people that you'd be listing. Because what human beings admire most is self-sacrifice. We really do love agape. You know, people will say things like, I admire those soldiers who are willing to put their life on the line. I admire those firemen. I admire those people who give up their own comfortable life to go and be a missionary, to go and do, you know, work with Doctors Without Borders, and to go and... People who sacrifice deeply, they elicit our admiration. But in order to have a world where it's even possible to sacrifice deeply, you have to have a world in which there are real problems to be overcome. And God has provided, one way or another, a world in which that's possible. We have a world with suffering in it. But part of that is it calls forth from us the ability to love. A couple of things that I will say, and I realize I have about 2 minutes. I see the crowds gathering in the back. So, as Christian, I mean, those are the arguments that I would give to answer the logical argument when somebody is really bothered by this. I think you can say some of those things. But I think in dealing with the emotional faith struggle, every one of us is going to deal with that eventually. And some of the resources I recommend, I think, is the lesson from Job and the lesson from the life of Jesus Christ. Job, the whole book of Job, is basically kind of a written drama where you've got so-and-so speaks, then so-and-so speaks, then so-and-so speaks. And they are the smartest people of their age. That's kind of how those characters are introduced, Eliphaz and Job and the others. And they can't really come to a resolution on this problem. They go round and around. Why would God do this? Well, he's probably punishing you. No, he's not punishing me because this is the kind of life I don't know what it is. And they can't resolve it. And Job is so frustrated. He says, I wish God himself would show up. I wish God would come and answer my questions. Man, if he would show up, I would march up to the throne of judgment with the life story, with my deeds written on my shoulders. And I would approach him like a prince. I would say, I dare you to judge me and find me. I mean, that's what Job says, right? I mean, he says that. I can't imagine marching up to the throne of judgment like that. But he's mad. And so what happens at the end of the book of Job? God shows up. You know, what Job has been asking for all along, that happens. And there I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be great because God's going to kind of lay it out in this nice syllogism why evil suffering takes place. And you know what? God doesn't answer the question either. God says, Job, you've been asking a lot of questions. And in human terms, you're really smart. Let me ask you some questions. And he asks him a bunch of questions that Job, of course, has no answer to. Some of those we know how to answer today, but if God showed up today, he would have other questions he could certainly stump us with. And that's really the point. Job never gets an answer to his question, why suffering? And he doesn't need one. God kind of asked him all these questions, and at the end, Job says, I realize that I've been asking questions without understanding. I've realized that even if God told me the answer, I'm probably not smart enough to understand it. And God says, that's okay, Job. You don't have to understand this. Really, all you need to know is me. To know that I'm here. And Job, do you think that could be enough for you? And the great turning point in the book of Job is that that is enough for Job. He ends up saying, yeah, that's right. I submit in sackcloth and ashes. And that's really the turning point of the book of Job. Job doesn't have to answer this question to his complete satisfaction. He just has to keep his faith in God. So I think that's our answer in Job. I think our answer in Christ is even more powerful. As Christians, we believe God, who has all the power in the world, he can stop sin in an instant by taking away our freedom if he wants to. He can do it in 100 other ways as well. To deal with the problem of suffering, what's God's great plan? This is why it strikes the Greeks as foolishness. It strikes the Jews as a stumbling block. What is God's great plan to deal with the problem of human rebellion and human lack of love? It's a crazy thing of the all-powerful God submitting even to the point of death to his own sinful, wicked creatures and letting himself die on the cross. And what that tells me is that God has a purpose even in suffering. God is actually using suffering to change the world. If he does that in Christ, then sometimes I can just say, well, I may be filling up, like Paul says, I may be filling up the sufferings of Christ. I'm adding some of my own sufferings to the sufferings that God has already been using to make the world a better place. Those don't solve the problem. Those help ease the problem as we move forward in our lives of faith in God. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate that.